Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, where the island-chained nation sun shines from the Fukushima coast, and everybody gets extra rays when they're trying to soak them up. And my very special guest today is, with them rays, is got a very uniquely pronounced name, and he really hates it when people pronounce it wrong. And many do. So I'm going to allow him to introduce himself as well. What is your name, sir?
Eric Rice.
Eric Rice. Now, it's not spelt the way you think it is. It's A-R-I-K-R-E-I-S-S. All right? Like with the S-A from Mexico. Speaking of Mexico, it's one of the big things in the drug war and what have you. But anyway, he's the maker of the film Drug Lord, the documentary, which he is attempting to raise money for. So if you're listening to this right now and you think for yourself for a moment, how many billions do we spend on the drug war? How many people's lives are we destroying day in, day out by simply not doing anything about the ridiculous drug laws? And you might think there would be quite a lot of money. Might think it might be quite a lot of pain and suffering. And you might think that, hey, maybe it would be a good idea if somebody made like a couple of really, really hard-hitting documentaries with experts interviewed all over the way into Wazoo and not hold anything back. Such a endeavour is very rarely supported by the establishment viewpoint. And it is you, ladies and gentlemen, that we ask humbly for your donations so that we can actually finish this film. Eric needs about $3,200 and he needs it in the next 22 days. If anybody out there has ever suffered personally at the hands of the drug law, give him just a little something on his Kickstarter page, and we'll provide links with that on the audio archives and the YouTube videos and so on and so forth. But you can actually search it on Kickstarter, like, what was it, Drug Lord? Just search Drug Lord, L-A-W-E-D, on Kickstarter, should be there. And better yet, go to druglord.com, and everything's on there as well. Other than that, Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, the film and whatnot for the uninitiated.
Well, it started about 4.5 years ago, and I've been shooting thousands of hours of footage and editing for the last 3 years to condense a very complicated story into 100 minutes. But if you watch that 100-minute film, which will be released in the next couple of months, you'll know everything you need to know to completely crush any prohibitionist argument that you might encounter from ignorant people who haven't really understood the costs, the true costs of the drug war that was initiated about 40 years ago by the very nebulous President Richard Nixon.
The nebulous president. Could you describe the word nebulous in this context? I'm confused.
Well, Nixon was a very conspiratorial president, and he was running all kinds of black ops and psy ops, and the drug war was one of his ops that was basically a way of controlling the population through restricting the kinds of drugs that they were allowed to have legal access to, and also through criminalization of the drugs that they were likely to be using, so that in Richard Nixon's particular political agenda, to destroy the anti-war movement. So that's where our drug laws come from. They were basically a means of controlling the population. They had very little to do with public health. In fact, they had nothing to do with public health. That's all just a sham.
Didn't Nixon say he wasn't a crook? And didn't he also accuse the people that accused him of being involved in conspiracies? Didn't he accuse them of being conspiracy theorists?
In fact, that's where the term conspiracy theory comes from. Richard Nixon was trying to deflect attention from the actual conspiracy that he was running to get information, inside information on the Democrats' campaign by bugging their campaign headquarters.
He bugged their campaign headquarters, mate. I didn't even hear that.
So, Nixon was a very crafty, very devious, very evil man, and this is who basically created our drug laws, the architect of our modern drug control system, and we need to break free of that. We need to move forward and create drug laws that are fostering the best public health outcomes. That's the essential need for government to control drugs, to foster positive public health outcomes. Currently, we're spending billions of dollars cumulatively, trillions of dollars, if you consider how many countries around the world have followed the U.S. model, have been coerced into following the U.S. model. We are finding there's more powerful, cheaper, and more prevalent narcotics of every stripe available every single day. You can't walk out your front door without tripping over a needle in some places, a heroin needle in some places in this town. So it's a very unsalubrious situation that the drug laws have created, and we need to be thinking about health, public health. Drug laws don't preserve the public health. They make the public health worse.
Specifically how?
Well, in the case of, let's say, cannabis, let's back away from the heroin example and talk about cannabis, which is what the film focuses on. If somebody actually does have a cannabis addiction and they get arrested, they're not going to get treatment, or they're very unlikely to get treatment in most cases, in a prison. In fact, when they are released from prison, they'll have now gone in with maybe an undergraduate degree in cannabis, and they may leave with a postgraduate degree in methamphetamine. They might be conscripted into a gang. They might be assaulted. They might have post-traumatic stress disorder from experiencing imprisonment. And if you try and find their victim, you can't. So they haven't actually hurt anyone.
My perspective is that the education system has a graduate course called prison. And that's a lot of the thing that's actually problematic about any kind of law, is that you wind up molding people in certain ways, and it's usually got unintended side effects.
Yeah, the unintended consequences of the drug war, well, there's an entire chapter dedicated to that in our film, the film that we're trying to raise money for, Drug Lord, which you can see at druglord.com.
There's nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion.
So in one of the chapters, we've divided the film into 10 chapters, so that if you are an internet viewer, and we're making it free for everyone in the world to see this film, this is basically our attempt to help foster better public education, and we're not trying to profit from it. If we do, that would be great. It would be nice to make some of the money back, but we're going to release the film free, and if you watch part 6, which is entitled The Costs of the Drug War, you'll see it's the longest segment of the film, because the costs of the drug war and the knock-on consequences of the drug war are so numerous that we needed to spend about 25 minutes of our 90-minute film just talking about those costs.
Well, costs like what? Just monetary or human costs as well?
There are financial costs. There are social costs. If you look at the straight financial costs in New Zealand, a very small country, we're actually outspending the United States at a ratio of 2-1 or 3-1, depending on which numbers you choose. But at a minimum, we are outspending them by a factor of 2-1. And what?
That's per capita.
Per capita, yes. Per capita, exactly. There are only just over 4 million people in New Zealand, 320 million in the US. But we're still arresting people at a higher rate per capita, and we're still spending on the prohibition at least double, per person arrested and processed through the criminal justice system. So if you break down that figure, and I'd like to remind international viewers, that international listeners, that New Zealand is a tiny country. So these figures are monstrous if you compare it to the size of the country. $64 million spent each year in incarcerating cannabis-only offenders. Those are offenders with no violent history, no other convictions. So there's additional costs on top of that.
Well, think of a reasonable sized city in the United States spending $64 million.
That's just on incarceration. It's $200 million on policing, excluding the costs of the Air Force and the Navy, who are also out patrolling for crops along the coast and inland by flying over in helicopter searches, and also in the eradication procedure. So you can add X million for those operations. Then you've got the costs of the court. You've got the cost of something like the Law Commission, which investigated these things and came up with a very well-rounded, very balanced report, very conservative report, advocating for the decriminalization of cannabis and the legalization of the medicinal use of cannabis. And that report was instantly binned. And the report itself cost a few million dollars to produce over a course of 3 years. I've got the exact numbers, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it didn't cover the costs of advertising and promotion of the actual document that they produced. So then we have the costs of people who've lost their job now going on social welfare, draining the public coffers because they've lost their job due to an arrest or a dismissal because they've been caught with a small amount of cannabis, often a negligible amount of cannabis. You've got the cost of dependents of people who are incarcerated claiming on social welfare because their breadwinner has been removed from their family. You've got the costs, the social costs to that family of losing a member of their family in a meaningless, pointless gesture of moralizing the law to suit your own political agenda by incarcerating a father who's otherwise a competent father and a family man. And I've met many people who've experienced this, and some of them are in the film, where a family member is ripped from his community, and a son now is, you know, his entire life can be changed because he doesn't have a father figure. And then when his father returns to him several years later, that father will be psychologically damaged from the incarceration, won't be the same father that he was before he went inside, wouldn't have been able to provide for his family during the period that he was incarcerated, so the family then has to rely on the benefit. In some cases, the cost is even greater when the police seize the home under the Proceeds of Crime Act, and then this family now is reduced to a state of impoverishment because of state-sanctioned theft. And in many cases, people who have lost their homes are really innocent of the charges that the police bring against them. The police have a stock-and-trade technique of drumming up the charge as much as possible, because then it gives them the pretense to seize property under the Proceeds of Crime Act. So in the case of a...
it's about the money for them, isn't it?
It is all basically a money go-around. The entire drug war can be summed up in two words: profit scheme. And
it's basic high school economics. When you cut off supply, you don't reduce the price, you make it skyrocket.
Exactly. Creating the black market that we see all around the world. The third largest black market on Earth, by the way. The first being arms, the second being the illegal oil trade. So number three, valued at $350 billion a year, accounting for a large percentage of world trade, is the illegal drug trade. Thank you, Richard Nixon.
Yeah, it's an old story, and it just keeps getting told over and over and over again. Don't you think that people are just kind of like sick of hearing about the drug war, even sick of hearing about protests about it?
People have become numbed to the message, even though the message has been on key basically since the earliest days of normal in the United States. They've been saying exactly the same thing. And even though it's filtering through slowly, it's not filtering through to the general population quickly enough. So that's what this film is about, helping people understand the minutiae of the argument so that there's no more debate about it. This basically is going to end the debate. So the debate about whether to legalize cannabis, at very least, is over. It is over. The United States government has acknowledged that by allowing the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington states.
Technically, the United States didn't allow that. The states just do it themselves because they nobody in New Zealand has sovereignty.
Somewhat, yeah. They have a small degree of sovereignty. But in the case of Colorado and Washington, Attorney General Eric Holder, and we cover this in the movie Drug Lord, wrote a memo saying that the federal government will not seek prosecutions against legalized distribution of marijuana in those states when it does not contravene the state's own laws. So that's basically saying, go ahead, we are not coming after you.
Did that stop the DEA in California with all the coffee shops? Green Cross and all of that?
No, it did not. It did not. So we are taking a wait-and-see attitude, but it looks like Obama has given up the ghost on the drug war. Obama, let me just clarify something. Obama is no friend to the international marijuana community. And I say that despite the fact that he was a prime member of the Chum Gang in Hawaii. Growing up, he was notorious for being a hardcore pothead, stoner, reefer, blazing dude. He was at the center of that kind of activity at his high school growing up.
Sounds like presidential material to me, because you have to be a career criminal.
Yep. Well, you know, they say marijuana is the gateway drug. It's the gateway to being president of the United States of America, because the last three presidents, and probably a few before, including John F. Kennedy, used to do that in their youth. John F. Kennedy was probably doing that throughout the entire time he was president before he was assassinated. So, gateway to being the first four presidents of the United States, George Washington and the next three, all smoked pot. There's references to them doing it in their journals. They were all hemp farmers, incidentally. So, yes, the United States of America that gave us this prohibition has a very, very deep history and relationship with the cannabis plant. So where these prohibitions came from, it's a strange glitch that started about 1937, if you want to pinpoint where this historical glitch happened. But for the previous 10,000 years, humanity has coexisted with this plant like no other plant on the earth. It is the most useful plant on the planet.
If I take a sledgehammer to your computer and say it's not working anymore, is that a glitch? Because that's what they did, bro.
Yeah, it was more than I'm talking about a glitch in terms of historical time and humanity's relationship with the plant over the past 10 or 12,000 years, in fact.
Humanity's relationship with the plant never changed, because as far as I know, the drug law didn't stop anybody from smoking squat.
Well, it did change, because the drug laws have caused incarceration and widespread social strife. They've even caused disease outbreaks. So,
didn't it also cause higher drug use?
Oh, drug use has skyrocketed. In fact, if you look at the graphs which show where the drug war laws were initiated around the 1970s, you see a massive surge in drug use from that time continuing. And the more strident the drug laws are, the greater the drug use in any society, which is why we find that in Portugal and the Netherlands, where they've decriminalized the personal use and possession of drugs, drug use has declined quite markedly, especially amongst the youth, which is, of course, the whole reason why the vast edifice of these drug laws exists, to protect our children. Well, if you want to protect your children from drugs, you must decriminalize them, which decreases the likelihood of them using these drugs. So the entire patriarchal system of drug control is an absolute and abysmal failure in every single way.
Let's count the ways, shall we?
It's only a three-hour show, Vinny.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, the whole documentary that you spent goodness knows how many years compressing into, like, the best freaking work of exposing the scumbaggery of the drug law the world has ever seen has taken goodness knows how long. So, we're not going to be able to list them all. I don't know, do you have, like, a short list, like bullet points and what have you?
Bullet points? Can we go country by country here? Because as the documentary points out, the drug laws have affected directly at least 156 countries on this earth that are the signatories to the UN conventions, which are basically a facsimile of United States drug policies. And the United States thought it would be a great idea if all the countries in the world would sign on to their version of drug hell, essentially. Although I should point out, there were some countries that were directly conquered through military invasion that didn't sign these drug laws. But the U.S. didn't have to worry about that because they were an occupying force and they simply changed their local laws directly. They also did that in Japan, where, in fact, hemp is still grown and continued to be grown throughout the prohibition just for the use of the emperor's clothing. So there was an exception made just for the emperor and a farm in a town called Asomara. Aso is Japanese for hemp. It basically means hemp village. They continued to grow despite the fact that it was illegal throughout Japan in all its forms. So the emperor was the only one who was legally allowed to use some form of cannabis, if only as clothing.
I guess he was the asshole.
Well, no, the Americans were the assholes. But I'm just pointing out how essentially the influence of America is either indirect through political and diplomatic pressure or direct through military invasion, through occupation. And I think, you know, I hate to bash America, and I have nothing against our American listeners out there, and I, you know, God bless you all. I hope you stand up and take control. I'm just getting off topic a bit, but your government's gone fucking crazy. Are we allowed to swear on this show, Vinny?
It doesn't matter. I guess you can.
So rail it in, and the whole system that we've imported from there. That's the essential problem. We've imported a failed system.
You know what we should have done? Instead of importing their drug policy, is just import the drugs that they grow.
Well, they're actually not a huge... except for meth. They're not a huge...
Maybe not so much meth.
They're California, Humboldt County.
I'm talking about in terms of what we'd like to import to New Zealand, you know.
Oh, right. Well, in terms of, though, to break it down, their consumption rates are much higher than their production rates. They're the world's number one consumer of drugs, by far. That's despite having these strident drug laws in place to supposedly curb the consumption of drugs. Well, your drug laws are strident and your drug use is out of control. Can you not figure out the connection?
What percentage of the world's heroin was being grown in Afghanistan the year before the US invasion?
Very small percentage.
I believe it was 1%. And what percentage were they exporting 1 year after the US invasion of heroin from Afghanistan?
I'd guess at about 20-25%.
It was like around 75-90%.
Wow.
Climbing over the next few years.
Really? Wow.
It's my contention.
Yes.
That unless that heroin was frickin' illegal, the CIA wouldn't be able to get a whole lot of money for black ops that they could just sell all these drugs on the streets to all these dealers and pass them out in the black communities. And
absolutely,
hey, you know, beautiful.
Absolutely, they did that. It's documented. Air America, where they were using cargo planes to fly guns into Laos and Cambodia, fly out with packed with heroin. They were selling the heroin to their own GIs when they were on leave in Laos and Cambodia. So, you know, the CIA has been doing this since the CIA was born. And the CIA has a huge, huge role in the drug war as well.
Does it have a huge role in the film?
No. We couldn't cover everything. We do though take a look at FBI director Louis Freeh's involvement in New Zealand drug laws, and how he paid a personal visit to then Prime Minister Jenny Shipley and put the hard word on her that she needed to toughen up on the cannabis laws, despite being advised by her health select committee that the cannabis laws needed to be changed and reformed. And she said at first, her first reaction to that advice was, yes, we're going to take a good look at this. This is a serious matter. And within a few days, Louis Freeh had showed up and had this private meeting with her. And they made a joint statement to the press soon after that meeting. I don't know if it was directly or if it was the following day, but soon after they made a joint statement to the press that the cannabis laws in New Zealand were going to be toughened, because they need to send a strong message that there's a zero tolerance policy and cannabis is a deadly drug, etc., etc. All the old lies were trotted out for the press, who lapped it up. Because the New Zealand press doesn't actually engage with the fucking... Sorry, I swore again. Now I'm going to go on a rant about the New Zealand press. But, yeah, you know, it's I feel like I'm in a bit of a war without bullets. You know, I hope that we win. I hope that the side of sense and decency and love and community prevails in this war, the spiritual war that we're experiencing now.
I think it's a public awareness war as much as anything, really. I think if people had known the truth, you know, from the outset, what's this marijuana stuff? Well, it's cannabis. Well, frankly, I'm not outlawing that. I use cannabis all the time. My doctor treats me with it and everything. I make my clothes out of it. I freaking feed my kids with it. I use my animals for feed.
Animal feed, bedding.
So, you know, I can build my freaking house out of that stuff. And you're telling me that it's a good idea to make it illegal? Okay, just because you call it a fancy name, marijuana, which means Mary Jane, which is Mary and Jane, you know? Well, what do you think?
It was a great trick. It was a fantastic trick because many of the people who voted for that law had no idea that they were using cannabis and that they were making their own medicine, their own clothing, their own building material, their own etc. illegal. They had no idea it was the same substance that they were talking about. And I just want to drop in a little nugget from history at this point about where this term comes from. And everybody knows it was Randolph Hearst who popularized the term. But why he made that particular selection, that particular word, features in the song La Cucaracha. And that was the song that was being sung by the soldiers of Pancho Villa, who nationalized huge swathes of Randolph Hearst's forests in Mexico, which he had bought up to make paper. And so not only did he hate Mexicans for doing this, he was already a racist, but he particularly hated Mexicans because they took control over this land that he had probably bought up dirt cheap through some shady deal with the Mexican government that Pancho Villa overthrew. So he took this the word used in their song, in their freedom anthem, and he popularized that word as this ulterior word for this new killer Mexican loco weed. So it was no accident that he called it that. He had a bone to an axe to grind with those particular Mexicans, with that particular subgroup of Mexicans, yeah. And he ground it pretty well.
I was just trying to steal some land, that's it.
So yeah, the tree connection, the forestry connection, then of course many people know about, was because of paper and the success that cannabis was finding with new technology in the paper making process, and Hearst wouldn't allow the competition. So
Don't you find that kind of ironic, how it was a war between paper and weed?
It was a war between, yeah, it was a war between resources.
Yeah, but don't they kind of need each other, you know?
Yeah, yeah, they do, they do. They do indeed. But very clever people, very insidious people have created the system that we're living in today. These people are all dead. Nixon's dead, Hearst is dead, Anslinger's dead, but their ghosts are still in charge. You know, they have more power now in terms of shaping the world than they did when they were alive, just because of their legacy.
You know, what occurs to me now is that so many people have left a legacy, so many people have left a mark on the world, marks that may never actually ever go away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and like war, for example, it just never freaking ends. It's always going on. Why? Because, oh, well, there's a whole bunch of people in the military-industrial complex who want all the money in the world and don't really want to share it, so they've found a convenient way to do both. Kill all the people that might share their wealth, and make wealth while they're killing them.
Absolutely. War is the number one business on this planet, by far. There's not even a close second.
Drugs, you know.
No, you got to get down. Especially the oil, CIA, then drugs. Let's.
But it is gold, oil, and drugs. Those are our god. Gold, oil, drugs. Yeah.
But in terms of how the drug war ties in with the military-industrial complex, now it's overt. You've actually got a slave labor force in American prisons and in UK prisons as well, who are being paid $2 a day to manufacture the parts of weapons that go into bombs that get dropped on other countries. So Halliburton and the Carlyle Group not only bilk the taxpayer by not having to pay taxes on their slave labor force, who they are paying a tuppence to produce these weapons, but then Halliburton can then drop bombs on U.S. citizens, which they've done through error, and they still get paid for those bombs. They still get paid. It's not like that the U.S. taxpayer can demand a refund when Halliburton accidentally kills some of American soldiers in now Afghanistan, and they're still in Iraq, even though the war is technically over. But this has happened where they bombed their own soldiers. It's not like the U.S. taxpayer can demand a refund on the cost of those bombs. You know, that money's in Halliburton's bank account. So, sorry guys, we drop bombs on our own guys. Too bad, we still get paid.
Now, if we're talking about the military-industrial complex, so Eisenhower warned people about this, didn't he? You know, mm-hmm. He didn't say, hey, well...
This is his final address to the American people.
I mean, just think about that. You know, my last chance to tell the American people something, and instead of saying, thank you, I've been a great president, or anything, he says, I'm warning you, there's a bunch of criminal scum who can have a huge quantity of stuff. Oh, we've got a phone ringing. And who can... basically, take over the country and enslave all of you. That was the last thing he decided to tell people as President of the United States. And they completely ignored him. Didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And
as a result of them ignoring the warnings, you now have an enormous system where the exact thing that he warned against happening has already happened. There are military-industrial scumbags in charge of everything, you know? Isn't that the way of things, ladies and gentlemen, that every single time that somebody gives you some really good advice, you ignore them and keep doing what you're doing anyway?
In fact, that is the pattern. I'd just like to point something out about Eisenhower, in that he was one of the key presidents to build up the military-industrial complex. And he only recognized the error of his ways right at the end. But he's definitely not blameless. And if Eisenhower had woken up to the threat that he was himself creating, maybe he would have acted differently. But I don't think he was really in control. I think that the American presidents are mainly puppets, and their masters twiddle their strings and they talk. And then after he was released from the presidential obligations that he had signed on for, he was able to speak a little bit more freely. So that was the message of his closing address. But we've seen a massive militarization throughout the world based around the drug war. The drug war, Professor David Nutt points this out in our films, in the film Drug Lord. He says that the DEA are perhaps the number one threat to world peace in terms of the way they've militarized zones of the world through the enforcement of their drug policies and their eradication programs.
And this actually sounds all too familiar. Have you ever noticed how every single time they say, oh, we're going to solve this problem for you, it's actually them that caused the problem in the first place, or there was no problem there in the first place at all? And then guess who profits by these solutions that they're going to propose? It'll save everybody from these problems that they either caused or never existed.
It's the law enforcement agencies, it's the prison industrial complex currently under the control of Serco, the same people who build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, a UK multinational. So it's like I said, it's a profit scheme. Serco builds the weapons, Serco houses the prisoners, Serco controls the crowd. That's one of the other things they do. They do crowd control, sort of paramilitary operations. They're bad people. They're not the kind of people that you want the government of this country to be signing indefinite contracts with, which is what their control over two private prisons in this country has wed the government to.
Definitely not indefinitely. That would be... That'd be very, very nice and damn skippy, would it not? However, it occurs to me that public policy does not get made by the people that the policy governs. They get made by people above the law.
Yeah, the way the lawmaking process...
Could you elucidate on that, actually? How equally are these drug laws applied? Are the rich just as likely to get busted for pot on the side of the street as a poor person?
The chances of you being arrested and prosecuted and going to prison and all of, you know, the rollout of an arrest, at each stage, it is higher depending on your race, and lower depending on your income. So, for example, in this country, the most likely group of people to be arrested are Maori males. Young Maori males are the number one group of people being arrested in New Zealand. They're four times more likely to be stopped and searched. They're seven times more likely to be arrested. They're seven times more likely to... be charged. They are five times more likely to be convicted, and when convicted, they are five times more likely to receive a prison sentence than a white defendant. So these statistics are borne out in the United States in almost identical ways in terms of black. You substitute black male for Maori male, and you see basically an exact same chart in terms of how people are arrested and discriminated against based on their race and their income.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like eugenics to me.
Well, it could be considered that way. You're definitely filtering out a certain segment of the population and reducing their chances of procreating. So it is a form of eugenics. It's definitely shaping the population. In America, you've got one in four black men having been arrested. That's an obscene number, you know. In New Zealand, you've got 15% of the Maori population has been arrested. 15% is a very scary statistic. So, you know, there has to be some kind of sorry. Let me correct that. 15% of the population is Maori, and 51% of the prison population is Maori. So that's a huge disproportion in terms of the representation of the population in the prison compared to the general population. We've got to change these because we're disenfranchising huge swathes of the population.
I think that's the agenda. Who benefits?
Ki bono, exactly. And... And in this case, it's rich white guys who benefit. It tends to be. Rich white guys set up the drug laws that we have. Harry Anslinger, Richard Nixon, Randolph Hearst. In fact, I'm going to mention that I think the key figure in the entire conspiracy against the cannabis plant was a former Treasury of the U.S. Secretary, Andrew Mellon, who was at that time one of the richest men, if not the richest man in America, who financed the DuPont Chemical Company, and who also financed the Mellon Institute of Research, which produced the research that said that fluoride's good for your teeth back in the 1930s. And based on that bogus research from 84 years ago, however long, we still fluoridate our water, even outside of the U.S. This stupid idea has caught on.
Incidentally, you know how you were telling us the statistics of, Maoris in prison and the blacks in prison and all that kind of thing because of the drug war? Well, I saw a stat that fluoride affects black people's teeth worse and Hispanic people's teeth worse than white people, and in some cases, twice, if not three times as badly.
Really? I it wouldn't surprise me. Fluoride is not good for you. Anyone who's listening to this should stop drinking fluoridated water. I try to avoid it myself, but it's very difficult. You don't actually know what they're putting in the water. It could be something much worse than fluoride, and you better hope it's pharmaceutical-grade fluoride, because it's usually just toxic fluoride that's waste material. So thanks for listening.
With like about 17 trace minerals and stuff in it, you know, all conspiracies tie into all other kinds of conspiracies, and you know, that's the problem with being a proud conspiracy theorist as I am, is that I just think that nothing's too crazy, really. Everything seems to have a reason for people suspecting it, and if it comes from an official source, it's most likely the direct opposite of whatever they're saying it is. Cannabis is evil, it's useless, it destroys your brain, it kills your liver, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just all bollocks.
It is. Ronald Reagan came up with some corkers. I mean, back in the day when he was president, he made a statement that marijuana could turn out to be the most dangerous drug that is in use in our country today. And the preamble to that statement was that he's disappointed in the media for not bringing attention to the subject when the media were basically yapping zero tolerance throughout his entire zero tolerance campaign that his wife orchestrated. So the media was being extremely obedient, but he was nevertheless disappointed in them. And very few people know that Reagan himself was a salesman for Chesterfields. He was a salesman for the tobacco companies, and he did that for a long time. I mean, you see him age throughout these endorsement photographs. He ages over a period of about 35 years. So he was doing that for a while. I mean, promoting cigars, promoting Chesterfields. There's a Christmas ad of him holding up a pack of Chesterfields, saying get your friends a carton of Chesterfields for Christmas. So this is the same dude who claimed that marijuana is the most dangerous drug in America when cigarettes kill 500,000 Americans every year. It's by far the number one killer drug in America and, in fact, in the world. I'd like to just drop this number on people. 6.3 million deaths per year, according to the World Health Organization, caused by cigarettes, and an additional 600,000 deaths per year, 300,000 of them children, from secondhand smoke, pushing our total to just under 7 million deaths a year from Ronald Reagan's second favorite drug, because I think he had a penchant for alcohol.
Which is again dwarfed by a new study of the American Medical Association, which was found to kill 40 million people a year.
Yeah, alcohol is the most, in terms of social harms and in terms of harms to the user, alcohol vies for first place with heroin as the most dangerous drug. And depending on which index you use, it's actually number one.
I'm talking about like hospital accidents and stuff like that. You know, just you're actually more likely to be killed by a doctor than anything. Did you know that?
Oh, right.
And also, if you have the letters MD after your name, I found this out earlier, you're 11 times more likely to be a serial killer.
11 times more likely. That's interesting. That's interesting. I'm glad I'm not a doctor.
I'm not saying all doctors are killers. It's just you're 11 times more likely to be one.
Right, right. Well, there's an interesting study in New Zealand about health professionals that found that they use cannabis at a far higher rate than the average population. So maybe we need to get those serial killing doctors high, and
I'm not sure it would help because there's a reason why doctors are on drugs themselves, on prescription medications, are heavy drinkers, heavy smokers, and all of that. Okay, is because I believe that the medical industry got taken over by the Rockefeller Foundation, basically. All right, and now they teach everything. They tell you, okay, well, you're going to use drugs. Why are these drugs? What are they made out of? Well, they're made out of waste products that we can't actually use in our petroleum products. You mean like waste stuff from a well that doesn't break down and is really dangerous and stuff like that and has psychoactive effects? Yeah, those kind of drugs. Are you telling me that these are the only things that we can prescribe people now in order to help them with diseases and none of these drugs cure? Yep, that's right. Okay. That's really depressing. I think I might go smoke some weed.
It is depressing. It's basically like what you describe, except they use, sexy women, and I've met them, to seduce these doctors into buying their drugs, wining and dining them. They have massive budgets. They get paid really well. And they're not just women. They're men as well. Pharmaceutical reps I'm talking about. And they cajole these doctors into taking, the drug, testing it, prescribing it. They get their kickbacks. They get their Diners Club card, verified. Who knows what they're getting. But they're getting sweet deals from these pharmaceutical companies who are spending $100 billion a year to advertise their toxic products to the general population so that you become a lifelong dependent on whatever product it is that you were unfortunate enough to be prescribed.
And they only give you drugs that you can't grow yourself.
That's true. Or, in the case of GW Pharmaceuticals, profit off the fact that you cannot grow cannabis, whereas they have three gigantic warehouse facilities in the United Kingdom producing very high-grade medicinal marijuana. So their market share is legally protected. They're loving it. They're loving it. And they're loving the fact that a little spray of Sativex costs $500, and that'll last you 1 week. So if you have MS, well, you better have $500 a week for your Sativex, because you can't get it any other way legally in this country.
You're going to be freaking kidding me. It's almost worth the risk getting busted, isn't it?
Oh, well, many people are taking that risk. And, with the prevalence of use in this country, it being tied with Australia for number one in terms of its consumption of cannabis, even though there are so many people being arrested, there's just this vast group of people who are growing, distributing, and never having any interdiction with the law. Because just of the numbers, the police are overwhelmed. They're scurrying about as fast as they can to arrest as many people as they can, and they're not even making a dent in the overall population who are using.
Just dents in individuals' lives that kind of destroy them forever.
Big dents in the individual's life, but no dent in terms of... In fact, as we pointed out, they're having the opposite effect, because as you drive up the price through these scurrilous legal maneuverings, you incentivize people from entering that black market. Incentivization is what drives the economy, and that's what was a gigantic gift to crime when they made drugs illegal. The biggest gift to crime ever. In fact, organized crime was based around the prohibition of alcohol. So thank you very much for that stupid prohibition, because all the other organized crime networks that developed in the United States after the 1930s were established during that period.
I thought they called that the Senate.
Oh, well, that's another gang. There's a lot of gangsterism that the documentary hints at in terms of governmental gangsterism. That, this cabal of people that made marijuana illegal and the cabal of people that perpetuates the prohibition are themselves a gang, and they operate as a gang. The only difference is that you, the taxpayer, give them a salary, as well as the other little income streams that they manage to generate through their gang activity.
Which is why I would prefer to be governed by the mafia, Because at least when I give the mafia protection money, I get protection.
You get protection, exactly. Exactly. You're giving protection money to the state of the gang state. Currently, the chief gangster is your Prime Minister, John Key, who is a financial crook. Anyone out there who thinks that John Key is cool, go kill yourself. He's not a cool person. He is a bad man.
He's not being too harsh. Seriously, kill yourself. You have nothing of use to offer the human race.
Exactly. Your genes should be extinguished.
You should sell all your assets. You should sell all your assets. Get yourself massively in debt, okay? That's the best thing for you. Because then you will be homeless, destitute, and die of your wounds.
I better not rant too much about Johnny K because I'm going to be applying for my citizenship in a few months. And I don't want some of his agents.
Swear. Yeah, but you don't have to swear allegiance to JK.
Please, Johnny K. Don't kick me out.
Please,
don't
Johnny
kick
K.
me out.
That should be quite funny to see you.
I retract my earlier statement. No, he's a powerful man. I don't know if people out there know, but he was a Merrill Lynch bankster before he became Prime Minister of New Zealand. And this is my prediction, listeners out there, that in approximately 6 months, just before the next general election, Johnny Kay is going to bring his friend Barry O out here so that they can have a little powwow and look presidential next to each other. And that's what's going to win Johnny Kay a third term. Just that PR stunt. That alone is going to make stupid New Zealanders vote for him. That PR stunt alone is going
you
to
mean
win the election.
Bringing over the US president who in his first term, maybe even his first year if I remember correctly, borrowed more money than all previous presidents combined. He will come
fiscal
over
responsibility,
here in
baby.
Order to back up the re-election campaign of the man who got elected in 2008. And in his first term or his first year, I remember correctly, borrowed more money than any other New Zealand prime minister in history.
Yep, the pattern there is difficult to ignore. And
it doesn't stop there. They also both come from a blue political party, and
that's right.
They were also both elected in 2008.
That is, and they were both working for financial institutions at some point. In fact, I think it's the same financial institution. They both worked for Merrill Lynch. So you might want to fact check me out there, listeners at home, but I believe they both worked for Merrill Lynch.
You know what I reckon? They're having sex.
I wouldn't put it past John Key to be some kind of, you know, I'm not saying gay is deviant, but some kind of deviancy there, you know, probably not something we want to talk about.
Like an artificially sweetened deviant, like a steviant.
A steviant. I think John Key is probably going to invest in robotics to make some kind of a robot sex doll that he can have sex with. I think that's his particular stripe of deviancy. Because he's not completely human, so he cannot enjoy having sex with a human.
Well, you can't say that he's not completely human. I mean, he did deny that he was a reptile.
Did he? Did he actually make that formal denial?
Yes. The media forced a denial out of him. They got a denial that he was a reptile.
Really? Well, I'm still not convinced. I mean, he's definitely a cold-blooded individual. Wow, that's a powerful picture. Let me see that again. Sorry, viewers at home. Put that up on the screen. No, leave my branding. In case we never put the podcast out, we've got some great branding behind me for the film Drug Lord, Druglawed. Go to our Kickstarter campaign. And give us some money to finish this film, please. We're going to be distributing this all over the world. You'll be able to download it on the internet. We've got t-shirts ready. If we ever put the podcast out, you'll see the Drug Lord t-shirt that I'm wearing now. You can get those on the Kickstarter site. Please visit us. And even a small donation of $1 is something that helps us because it ups the number of people who've backed us and then creates confidence in the people who subsequently see the Kickstarter page.
Yeah, who knows? It might get rolling, you know. We had this picture of John Key on the cover of Crime Magazine, you know, like Time Magazine, except it's Crime.
Crime Magazine. Yeah, there he is.
Yeah, Prime Sinister.
Smiling.
It's just some kind of a demonic
grin.
It's the bangster smile, bro. The bangster smile. It is. You know? It's real nasty. And we've also got. I've got so many pictures of him on the website. Like, honestly, he's been putting the dick in dictator in this country since 2008. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen. And we kind of turned into a nation of sheep, ironically, for New Zealand.
It is.
Well, you know, it was real funny, Eric, actually. I'm going to tell you this. John Key had so many articles in TV3 and TVNZ and frickin' The Herald and every single other form of New Zealand media and scum in this country, right? Saying that he lied about something, all right? He lied about this. He lied about that. He slipped them off on this and all that. And then, article comes out. John Key, guess who's the most trusted and most liked? Prime Sinister.
M2's Man of the Year, John Key. He was on the cover of M2. Now, and I have to scratch my head in wonder at the total lack of discernment of the New Zealand media, the mainstream media, yourself accepted.
Well, and the people themselves. I mean, like there was a study that went out that they said, I think, like 40% of respondents said that John Key was sexy, and which I think highlights the drinking problem that we've got in this country.
Yep, we definitely have a drinking problem in this country. Alcohol is the number one drug problem in this country, listeners. There's a binge drinking culture. 10% of Kiwis are alcoholics, according to a recent study. You know, it's pretty much out of control. You see, when the All Blacks run out on their rugby field to bash each other senseless and everybody cheers, they got Lion Nathan's branding all over them. So their principal sponsor is an alcohol company, an international alcohol company. The public picks up the cost, the $16 billion annual cost, excluding knock-on costs, of damage through alcohol.
Knock-on costs? Is that a rugby pun?
No, not really. Not really. I want to get off the subject of rugby in case we have New Zealand listeners who disapprove of me pointing out the fact that rugby is costing your health system almost as much as cannabis prohibition. Not quite, but a large percentage of your health costs are borne by rugby.
Who ever thought that rugby was hazardous to your health? You know, you ever thought the massive tackles and all the injuries would have possibly given that one away earlier? But we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Arik Rice is my guest, and we'll be right back, folks. Don't you go anywhere.